You know, when it comes to the search for lost civilizations or Atlantis or however you want to put that, Easter Island is top of my list personally of places that I think is worth checking out. And the Moai, the stone heads that are basically synonymous with the place, they found another one in 2023, and that was a pretty big deal because these don't pop up very often. They pretty much thought they had found all of them. And this made the rounds in the news. Good Morning America was where the announcement was first made, and then it just kind of made the rounds in all these little articles, and then couple years later, here we are, we're talking about it again, but just like before, basically what we have are news articles that take threadbare information and put out content in order to get ad revenue. I'm not going to do that to you, I promise. What I'm going to actually do is make sure and beat that bar by a country mile. We're going to talk about the implications of this head, what some of the people are saying about it, and what science says about the lake that it came from, the implication, how important the lake was to the region. We're going to learn something today, boys, and we're going to talk about Easter Island and this cool-ass new Moai. So strap yourselves in, and we're going to be, hi, my name's Dan, and welcome to Dunking. In early 2023, Salvador Tanjito, the vice president of the Organization of Native Easter Islanders known as Mauhenwa, announced to Good Morning America that new Moai had been discovered in the drying lake bed. The lake is known as Rano Waraku, and it lies inside of a volcanic crater. And its level goes up and down, it varies a lot over the years. In 2018, it almost dried up entirely. And in 2023, this is where they found that Moai head, right? But this lake is very important to the region for a few reasons, and including spiritual ones, but also just, you get water from lakes, don't you? And indeed, the Lake of Rano Waraku is one of the few freshwater lakes on the island, and as such, it's been valued by the locals for a very, very long time, a source of human and animal life alike. Now, there's three main lakes on Easter Island, and that fresh water was supplemented by what's known as coastal water discharge. That's basically right around an area that's like an island. A lot of times you can find fresh water right where it's running off of the coast before it hits the sea. Like, it's, as it's hitting the seawater, there'll be a little area of fresh water. And so they gathered that in order to keep their population density high. I mean, let's be clear, that's one of the interesting things about Easter Island, is at times they had a pretty high population density for such a small region. And fresh water would have definitely been one of the hardest hurdles for them to have jumped in order to have achieved that. And that's not the only reason that makes this lake important. There's one other reason, too. It's the main source for the volcanic tuff, that's the stone that they quarried, that was used in the vast majority of the Moai that are on Easter Island. There's about 1,000 of them, and over 900 are made from tuff. And almost all of that tuff came from that lake. So yeah, what we're saying is that in that lake you could find the Moai that was probably quarried there. What you won't find inside that lake is today's sponsor, The Land of 10,000 Mysteries by Samuel Sable. How's that for a segue? Do you like searching for anomalous locations on Google Earth, but find the end result is often less than exciting? Have you looked at LiDAR images and thought to yourself, I wish I could access this sort of data? Do you like traveling around and looking for anomalies in that sort of data? If you answered yes to any of those, then this book is for you. The Land of 10,000 Mysteries by Samuel Sebold explores the unknown anomalies in central Minnesota. With over 80 full-color maps and descriptions that clearly show Sebold's intimacy with the region, this book shows the topography of central Minnesota like no book before it has, and just as importantly, includes Sebold's description and musings on the region being shown. From potential structures to roads to causeways to challenging the mainstream idea of the glaciation of the region, The Land of 10,000 Mysteries has a look into Minnesota's past that few have pondered and even fewer have seen the evidence of. Count yourself among the few with the knowledge of Minnesota's long-lost past with Samuel Sebold's The Land of 10,000 Mysteries. Link to purchase is in the description. Thank you for your order and a big thanks to Samuel for supporting the channel by sponsoring this video. All right, thanks, Sam, for sponsoring the channel, and now back to Easter Island. And it's true that some of the Moai were made of basalt or scoria or trachyte, but the vast majority were made from volcanic tuff, and again, the vast majority of that was quarried right there at Lake Rano Waraku. This has resulted in the site becoming sacred to the modern indigenous people and hugely popular with archaeologists and amateur historians alike. This is where almost every unfinished Moai lies, and it's the source of almost every other Moai on the island. And now, we have Moai slowly being found in the lake itself. And this opens up a number of questions, like obviously the first one is, why was this in the lake? I mean, it's a small Moai, around 4 foot, 5 foot tall. And the big thing is, Moai are made to represent high-ranking nobility of the Rapa Nui people. So why was it, like, chucked in the water? Was it, like, were they trying to erase a ruler? Was it, like, some way of punishing the family line? Or was it some symbolic sacrifice or something to appease the water gods in a year without much water? Or did it just slip out of somebody's hands while they were quarrying it and slide down into the mud and end up there? There's a whole lot of different questions that you could ask about this. And the problem is that Rapa Nui was a target of slave raids. And in the 1860s, it was just hammered. And a lot of slave traders came over from Peru in multiple waves, and they targeted the nobility, and there was almost nobody left on the island when it was all said and done. And the ones that were left there, of course, the last thing on their mind was making sure their history was intact when they're trying to keep their kids from being sold into slavery. So they basically lost everything. There's the Rongo Rongo script that many of you are aware of, I'm sure. It's these interesting characters. It's hieroglyphic style writing that still has eluded all manners of interpretation. So hopefully maybe AI will get us there one day, but who knows, right? Fact of the matter is, there was a bunch of people here just a couple hundred years ago that could have read the shit, and well, they were erased. And that's really, really frustrating. And sad, and it's especially irritating when it's like 300 years after we saw the same thing happen. Not, you know, the place where the slave traders came from, they should have had some historical knowledge that they were wiping out important shit, but I digress. Now, most of the experts believed that all the Moai had been found, so finding a new one is a big deal, even if it is just a small one. I mean, it doesn't appear to be just partially finished, and I didn't see any reports saying it's incomplete. And this dovetails very well with the parts of the debate about Easter Island that people have been discussing for damn near a century now. I mean, Thor Heyerdahl was the first one to really ruffle some feathers when he wrote his book Aku Aku. And in that book, he says that basically the Tiwanaku and the platform that the Moai went on, the old Moai, the big seven sages that everybody knows, off the famous one, that one has similar architectural stylings. And he was just blasted for saying that there was any way that these things could be connected. And really quickly, let me just rant. That's absurd. People that could find a teeny little pinpoint out in the middle of the ocean could probably find a whole strip of continent right next to it. But oh no, 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 that's impossible. This is a kind of ridiculous. But the thing is that Thor Heyerdahl's been vindicated. Now, in archaeology, the lowest habitat layer is the oldest known layer of an area that exhibits signs of human habitation. On Easter Island, the lowest habitat layer is found at Anakena. At this site, which mind you doesn't go back more than about 1,000 years or so, we find both South American crops and Asian crops. Human DNA studies also showed that both the ancient and modern Easter Island population have about 10% of their DNA made up of South American DNA. They can actually trace a genetic signal going out into Polynesia from South America. So not only is Thor Heyerdahl vindicated, a lot of his critics have egg on their face. They made a knee-jerk reaction based on their own personal assumptions and went out and screamed to the world, this man's an idiot. And it turned out that they were the fucking idiots and this man was right. Now, I'm not going to say that there's anything like that that could possibly be happening in the modern day, because we all know science gets better and there is absolutely no possible way that they would repeat these kinds of stupid-ass mistakes over and over and over again when some dumb fuck like me can tell you that it's a problem. That's... Anyway, to make matters worse, the Rapa Nui people, they have a myth about the settling of Easter Island, one of the little bit that we still know about their beliefs, and they believe that people found the island, like they were looking for it, they found it, they went back to their king guy, Hotu Matau, and were like, hey buddy, we found the place, and then they were like, okay, let's prepare to settle, and they went and got a bunch of shit, and then went to the island with a bunch of people en masse. They planned this thing out, almost like it was like a sacred place to them, or an important part of the world to them, or something, as Polynesian people, almost like the myth could have told them that, hey man, this place might have had you might have had some to look here. There's some plan that went into this, according to the guys that said the myth. But why would we listen to the indigenous people have anything to do with what they have to say? We all know they just believe in spirits and live in caves, right? And we're the racist ones. Anyway, to me, one of the weirdest things about Easter Island is that it's considered an Axis Mundi, or a world navel, or a center of the earth, the first place that the creation began. These stones right here are the world navel. And this is not a concept unique to Easter Island, and that's what makes this so enigmatic to me. Anywhere else on the planet that you find an Axis Mundi, it's centrally located in a huge population center of a group of people. So Babylon, Jerusalem, Cuzco, Delhi, right fucking center basically of their empire. Not dead center, but it's centrally located in their empire. It's not in the far-flung corner, and it's not in some outcast area where nobody lives. But not in the Polynesian world. If you're Polynesian, your world navel, the one world navel they have, is way out in BFE. Hard to get to, easy to get isolated. The kind of thing that might inspire people to go look for it if it was considered their world navel. And they would be like, sound like an archaeologist here, they'd have a religious reason to settle that island and to hang out there, even though it's not going to be exactly the easiest place to get by. It would be much easier to be around people that you could trade with. And clearly they did have, contact with other places. But again, it's not going to be difficult to get stuck out there. Or say it the other way, it's going to be very difficult. It's going to be a hard voyage, right? It's not like you're just popping from one island to the next to the next to the next. So anyway, why would they have their world center, the beginning of creation? Why is the center of their world off in the middle of nowhere? Well, before the Younger Dryas, before the seas rose, and before Plato tells us that Atlantis sunk into the sea, Rapa Nui would be much larger and much less isolated. Part of a string of islands connecting South America to Southeast Asia, Easter Island would be potentially a major pit stop along the way from one continent to the other. This would explain why some of the Moai seem way older than others. It would explain the existence of the world navel on that island. And it could explain why we see statues thrown into the lake, assuming that there's more. Even if it's just the one, that could have been to like reenact the thing. It could have been some sacrifice, or it could have just fallen there and been buried in that during some sort of cataclysmic earth-shaking event. The fact of the matter is, finding that we have more Moai on the island does mean that there's more reasons to look on Easter Island. And that really gets me into my next major point about this, is when I mentioned earlier that Anakanapanakanastan,
I haven't got enough Anakanapanasan.
And I said that that was the earliest habitat layer that we know of. I'm quite certain personally that if we dug a lot more, we would find a lot more at Easter Island, a lot deeper. I do think that place was settled a long time ago. And I do think that we see the social fingerprints and the actual physical fingerprints on the island. We see it in the form of the Moai, and we see it in the form of the world navel, and we see it in their myth. And this is where I think that, if we actually did a lot of more archaeology on the place, and it is far flung, it's going to be expensive to do any work there. I get that. But I also think that there's a lot of public interest in the site. And it is the kind of place that where, if archaeologists and crazy pseudo guys like myself would just hold hands for 5 minutes and sing Kumbaya, those guys would get some work, and I'd have some more habitat layers to discuss on my videos. But instead, we'll just all argue with each other, and thankfully some other archaeologists that don't yell at me on the internet, they are still doing work out there, and I appreciate that a lot. But the ones that are standing in the same footprints of the guys that told Thor Heyerdahl he was just a dumbass, yeah, those guys, they're not doing anybody any good, least of all themselves. Now, of course, if we look at Easter Island and think about it from before the times of the waters rising around 12,000 years ago or so, the coasts would be the place to look, and they've all been swallowed up. So we would have to do some underwater archaeology, but even then, fresh water would have probably been at a premium at the place. So those sites that we know have had water for a very long time are probably worth investigating heavily. and of course are sacred to the locals. So once again, same old problems that we run into all around the world, but I do believe that we could find a lot of crazy stuff if we were to dig a lot more there. And now a lot of people are going to say, damn, you're looking for Atlantis out in the Pacific. What the fuck is wrong with you, man? And this is where I really think that we kind of get hung up on individual things and the specific myths. And I can't blame somebody for looking into the stuff in detail, because that totally makes sense. But I also have to say that, you know, when Plato says it's been 9,000 years, by his time, it's like, dude, you know how little we know? The details about World War II battles are lost to us, okay? And that's not even 100 years ago yet, okay? The historians will argue about where patches were placed in the Civil War, or what buttons belonged on what guy's uniform, and this is 200 years ago, right? Okay, this is... I ain't buying that there's going to be too many accurate bits of information from 9,000 years. You're going to have wisps. You're not going to have solid, hard data, my opinion. Unless you're playing games with the numbers and stuff like we've talked about when you're like discussing Hamlet's Mill and shit like that. But anyway, I digress. My point here is that when you're looking for lost civilizations, back Atlantis and all that kind of stuff, you don't want to look in just one spot, in my opinion, anymore. That look at what we do with the Clovis culture. The Clovis culture in Washington State was the same as the Clovis culture over in Illinois, is the same as the Clovis culture in New Mexico. Do you think they spoke the same language? Do you think they worshiped the same gods? Do you think they considered themselves the same people? Of course not. Come on, man. But they shared the same technology, so what do we call them? Clovis people. So, if you go 10,000 years into the future and humans still think like humans, and we look back now, we're the electronics people. You know, those guys in France and those guys in Korea, they both had electronics. So North Korea is France, is Brazil, is America, is Australia, is France. Oh, my God. But anyway, you get my point. They would just lump us all together into one big thing. And then so people that are like, oh, you find the electronics people by looking yada, yada, yada. So anyway, there's a lot of people that look for Atlantis in specific locations, and I'm not saying that some of the data that they're using isn't accurate. I just think that it's easy to get hung up under the trees, and in my opinion, it's like, if we stand back and look at it, there's more to it than just that. But anyway, that's Dan just kind of yabbering for a quick minute about it, because it's Easter Island, man. It's cool as shit. I'm going to talk about it. It's my channel. Sorry. No, but like Graham Hancock has said before, if you live in a world where you're like separated from nature to a degree by technology, a societal collapse, like the loss of that technology, could really fuck your world up. So the people who aren't all messed up in those times are hunter-gatherers. You know, even in times of famines and droughts, if you look around, they tend to do pretty damn well because they know where to go to find some water and food, even in the worst of times, right? That's their job. So a bunch of people can show up into these areas and transfer technology, and that's what hypothetically we have at places like Göbekli Tepe and potentially in other places like Tiwanaku and all around the world, you could say, if you are looking for fingerprints of the gods. Hey, you see what I did there? But seriously, these are the kinds of things that are tantalizing. You can dismiss them all you like. You can mock them all you like. But the fact of the matter is, the very things that people have mocked in the past, like this, over and over again, get borne out and proven to be true. And it doesn't mean that these things are true inherently. But what it does mean is that just dismissing them out of hand without doing your due diligence because it just sounds stupid, that's not science, brah. And if you're going to like use that to go on the fucking out into the internet or out into the social sphere and have an argument about scientific stuff, and try to portray yourself as team science, and you're rejecting things out of hand because it goes against your predetermined beliefs. And I want to point out, I'll give you a perfect smoking gun example so you're not just thinking I'm being vague here. Milo Rossi made the video about the Baghdad Battery. He had the Baghdad Battery on a little wheel that he'd spin, right? And it's a wheel of bad archaeology. So right off the bat, the Baghdad Battery is lumped in with bad archaeology. So when he makes his video, he doesn't do due diligence. He doesn't do proper research. And he shits all over it. And another archaeologist comes and corrects him. Now, Milo likes to say, well, that was, you know, that's just science, man. That's how science does itself. But the fact of the matter is, that's not how science does itself. That's dogma. Science wouldn't put the Baghdad Battery into a category of bullshit until it had tested it. A fucking YouTuber would, who is running from a dogmatic position. And this is the tradition that we see still borne out today by guys like Flint Dibble, yada, yada, yada. Anyway, I could bitch about that all day for those of you who've watched me before, so I'll stop again. But again, it's my channel, so I... Now, I'm going to be in Scottsdale, Arizona this December 5th through 7th for the Quest for Ancient Civilizations Conference. And my buddy Jimmy Crosetti's going to be there. My buddy Mike Collins going to be there. My buddy Gary Buechler's going to be there. You probably know him as Nerdrotic. My buddy Hugh Newman's going to be there. J.J. Ainsworth's going to be there. A.J. Gentile for the Y-Files is going to be there. A bunch of other people. Sorry, guys, I can't remember everybody's name. But a bunch of cool people are going to be there. You should come and check it out. And, I'll be there, too, as I think I mentioned that one already. But it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be in Arizona. Dude, it's Arizona in fucking December. Come on now. If you live up in Spokane, that just sounds good to begin with. Call me a snowbird. All right. Well, thank you guys very much for watching. I want to say thank you once more to Samuel Sabold for hooking me up with some sponsorships. And you guys have a great day.